You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, an event happened in the United States of America on November the 22nd, 1963, that has been forever etched upon the memory of anyone who experienced that day. It has been one of the milestones of world history in that, without any doubt whatsoever, it was the event that literally destroyed the political will of the nation. And it began with a dream. That dream, ladies and gentlemen, some called Camelot. Some have, over the years, said that this was indeed nothing more than a fantasy. There has been a concerted campaign to destroy the image of our fallen president. Indeed, it's been more than a concerted effort. It's been the all-out effort of many over the years. And to a great extent, they have been very successful in instilling the American people the idea that if he was such a womanizer, amongst other things, who cares who killed him? And that there are those who year after year make speeches and write books, each time coming up with a new theory and new evidence, always pointing away from the true murderers. Tonight, I hope that I can open your eyes and steer you back upon the right path. For broad is the way, and narrow is the gate.
When a star is born, it possesses a gift or two, and one of them is this: it has the power to make a wish come true. When you wish upon a star, make no difference who you
your heart is in your dream, you are
The nation at the time was looking for a leader. In fact, after having gone through one of the best decades in the history of the United States of America, and feeling as though we were all an instant away from incineration, the Cold War, you see, was at the height of its venom and propaganda. People in the 50s had built fallout shelters all around the world. People held their breath at the slightest indication that the superpowers were ready to collide. A young congressman named John F. Kennedy wrote a book called Profiles in Courage. And many of us derive courage from reading his book. No one ever dreamed that he would be a candidate for president against Tricky Dick.
I believe it incumbent upon the next president of the United States to get this country moving again, to get our economy moving again, to set before the American people its goals, its unfinished business, and then throughout the world appoint the best people we can get, ambassadors who can speak the language, not merely people who made a political contribution, but who can speak the language, bring students here, let them see what kind of a country we have. Mr. Nixon said that we should not regard them as pawns in the Cold War. We should identify ourselves with them. If that were true, why didn't we identify ourselves with the people of Africa? Why didn't we bring students over here? Why did we suddenly offer Congo 300 students last June when they had the tremendous revolt? That was more than we had offered to all of Africa the year before from the federal government. I believe that this party, Republican Party, has stood still really for 25 years its leadership has. It opposed all of the programs of President Roosevelt and others, from minimum wage and for housing, economic growth and development of our natural resources, the Tennessee Valley, and all the rest. And I believe that if we can get a party which believes in movement, which believes in going ahead, then we can reestablish our position in the world. Strong defense, strong economic growth, justice for our people, guarantee of constitutional rights, so that people will believe that we practice what we preach. And then, around the world, particularly to try to reestablish the atmosphere which existed in Latin America at the time of Franklin Roosevelt. He was a good neighbor in Latin America because he was a good neighbor in the United States. Because they saw us as a society that was compassionate, that cared about people, that was moving this country ahead. I believe that my responsibility as the leader of the Democratic Party in 1960 to try to warn the American people that in this crucial time we can no longer afford to stand still. We can no longer afford to be second best. I want people all over the world to look to the United States again, to feel that we're on the move, to feel that our high noon is in the future. I want Mr. Khrushchev to know that a new generation of Americans who fought in Europe and Italy and the Pacific for freedom in World War II have now taken over in the United States, and that they're going to put this country back to work again. I don't believe that there's anything this country cannot do. I don't believe there's any burden or any responsibility that any American would not assume to protect his country, protect our security, to advance the cause of freedom. And I believe it incumbent upon us now to do that. Franklin Roosevelt said in 1936 that generation of Americans had a rendezvous with destiny. I believe in 1960 and 61 and 2 and 3, we have a rendezvous with destiny. And I believe it incumbent upon us to be the defenders of the United States and the defenders of freedom. And to do that, we must give this country leadership and we must get America moving again.
Senator Kennedy has said tonight again what he has said several times in the course of these debates and in the campaign, that America is standing still. America is not standing still. It has not been standing still. Anybody that says America has been standing still for the last 7.5 years hasn't been traveling in America. He's been in some other country. Let's get that straight right away. Now, the second point we have to understand is this, however. America has not been standing still, but America cannot stand pat. We can't stand pat for the reason that we're in a race, as I've indicated. We can't stand pat because it is essential with the conflict that we have around the world that we not just hold our own, that we not keep just freedom for ourselves. It is essential that we extend freedom, extend it to all the world. And this means more than what we've been doing. It means keeping America even stronger militarily than she is. It means seeing that our economy moves forward even faster than it has. It means making more progress in civil rights than we have, so that we can be a splendid example for all the world to see. But we aren't going to move America forward, and we aren't going to be able to lead the world to win this struggle for freedom if we have a permanent inferiority complex about American achievements. Because we are first in the world in space, as I've indicated. We are first in science, we are first in education, and we're going to move even further ahead with the kind of leadership that we can provide in these years ahead. One other point I would make. What could you do? Senator Kennedy and I are candidates for the presidency of the United States. In the years to come, it will be written that one or the other of us was elected and that he was or was not a great president. What will determine whether Senator Kennedy or I, if I am elected, was a great president? It will not be our ambition that will determine it, because greatness is not something that is written on a campaign poster. It will be determined to the extent that we represent the deepest ideals, the highest feelings and faith of the American people. In other words, the next president, as he leads America in the free world, can be only as great as the American people are great. And so I say in conclusion, keep America's faith strong. See that the young people of America particularly have faith in the ideals of freedom and faith in God, which distinguishes us from the atheistic materialists who oppose us.
And of course, we all know who won that debate. John F. Kennedy won it by a landslide as Richard Nixon stood there with a 5 o'clock shadow, looking mean-spirited, as he later turned out to positively be. They didn't call him Tricky Dick, you see, for nothing. And I think the American people instinctively sensed that at that time. John F. Kennedy was personable, likable, handsome, young. And he had a way with words that made the nation fall in love with him. We all took time off from work, did whatever we could to be in front of our television sets to hear his inaugural address.
We observe today not a victory of party, but a celebration of freedom, symbolizing an end as well as a beginning, signifying renewal as well as change. For I have sworn before you and Almighty God the same solemn oath our forebears prescribed nearly a century and three quarters ago. The world is very different now, for man holds in his mortal hands the power to abolish all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life. And yet the same revolutionary beliefs for which our forebears fought are still at issue around the globe. The belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. We dare not forget today that we are the heirs of that first revolution. Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world. Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty. This much we pledge and more. To those old allies whose cultural and spiritual origins we share, we pledge the loyalty of faithful friends. United, there is little we cannot do in a host of cooperative ventures. Divided, there is little we can do, for we dare not meet a powerful challenge at odds and split asunder. To those new states whom we welcome to the ranks of the free, we pledge our word that one form of colonial control shall not have passed away merely to be replaced by a far more iron tyranny. We shall not always expect to find them supporting our view, but we shall always hope to find them strongly supporting their own freedom. And to remember that in the past, those who foolishly sought power by riding the back of the tiger ended up inside. To those people in the huts and villages of half the globe struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves. For whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich. To our sister republics south of our border, we offer a special pledge to convert our good words into good deeds, in a new alliance for progress, to assist free men and free governments in casting off the chains of poverty. But this peaceful revolution of hope cannot become the prey of hostile powers. Let all our neighbors know that we shall join with them to oppose aggression or subversion anywhere in the Americas. And let every other power know that this hemisphere intends to remain the master of its own house. To that world assembly of sovereign states, the United Nations, our last best hope, in an age where the instruments of war have far outpaced the instruments of peace, we renew our pledge of support to prevent it from becoming merely a forum for invective, to strengthen its shield of the new and the weak, and to enlarge the area in which its grip may run. Finally, to those nations who would make themselves our adversary, we offer not a pledge, but a request that both sides begin anew the quest for peace. Before the dark powers of destruction, unleashed by science, engulf all humanity in planned or accidental self-destruction. We dare not tempt them with weakness, for only when our arms are sufficient beyond doubt can we be certain beyond doubt that they will never be employed. But neither can two great and powerful groups of nations take comfort from our present course, both sides overburdened by the cost of modern weapons, both rightly alarmed by the steady spread of the deadly atom, yet both racing to alter that uncertain balance of terror that stays the hand of mankind's final war. So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. Let both sides explore what problems unite us, instead of belaboring those problems which divide us. Let both sides, for the first time, formulate serious and precise proposals for the inspection and control of arms, and bring the absolute power to destroy other nations under the absolute control of all nations. Let both sides seek to invoke the wonders of science instead of its terrors. Together, let us explore the stars, conquer the deserts, eradicate disease, tap the ocean depth, and encourage the arts and commerce. Let both sides unite to heed, in all corners of the earth, the command of Isaiah to undo the heavy burdens and let the oppressed go free. And if a beachhead of cooperation may push back the jungle of suspicion, let both sides join in creating a new endeavor, not a new balance of power, but a new world of law, where the strong are just and the weak secure, and the peace preserved. All this will not be finished in the first 100 days, nor will it be finished in the first 1,000 days, nor in the life of this administration, nor even perhaps in our lifetime on this planet. But let us begin. In your hands, my fellow citizens, more than mine, will rest the final success or failure of our cause. Since this country was founded, each generation of Americans has been summoned to give testimony to its national loyalty. The graves of young Americans who answered the call to service surround the globe. Now the trumpet summons us again, not as a call to bear arms, though arms we need, not as a call to battle, though in battle we are, but a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle, year in and year out, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, a struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself. Can we forge against these enemies a grand and global alliance, north and south, east and west, that can assure a more fruitful life for all mankind? Will you join in that historic effort? In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you. With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own.
And, ladies and gentlemen, the time that this man was president, he began to institute some changes that some Americans thought they would never see. As the Central Intelligence Agency began to mount their invasion of the Bay of Pigs in Cuba, the new president, not knowing anything about it, was hastily briefed. The result, of course, was disaster. It was, in fact, meant to be a disaster to destroy the movement against Castro in Cuba, to identify those who would fight against him and eliminate them, cementing communist foothold in the Caribbean, shattering the Monroe Doctrine. Whether John F. Kennedy was a willing participant in the failure at the Bay of Pigs, only those intimately involved will ever know. He then began to break down the old taboos in the South. A black person, instead of going to the back of the bus, sat in the front. Another black person sat at an all-white lunch counter. Another black student attempted to enroll in the University of Alabama, and the war began. John F. Kennedy and his brother sided with those who had been oppressed, who had been held down under the thumb of the old plague upon mankind, racism, and for that he was hated. The old Knights of the Golden Circle rose their ugly head again, and the Ku Klux Klan swept across the South. Violence erupted. People were murdered. People were hurt. Traditions were broken, and some were shamed, and many were confused. Later, upon a report from the Central Intelligence Agency, satellites began to focus their attention upon Cuba. The new spy plane called the U-2 began overflights, and photographs were shown to John F. Kennedy that were said to contain proof that the Soviet Union had intercontinental ballistic missiles on that island. which could be easily aimed and could easily reach any major American city within moments. I remember watching the television when we were told that the military had gone to alert and all ships proceeding for Cuba would be stopped and searched, and any carrying missiles or missile equipment or armaments would be turned around. I was in the United States Air Force at that time, and I can tell you that at Shepherd Air Force Base in the 494th, what was also known as the 4245th Strategic Wing, we were prepared to launch planes upon a moment's notice carrying atomic and hydrogen bombs, which would fly over the pole and strike their targets deep within Soviet territory. It was a tense time, and they say that Khrushchev blinked and that we won. Nobody knows really. Much of it is just as confusing as all of the rest of that period in history. And eventually, civil rights gained a foothold. And there were many who hated John F. Kennedy. And then on one fateful day, he made a trip to Dallas, Texas, rode in a motorcade down Main Street, took a little jog over to Elm. No reason for that jog unless you know what I know. And you'll hear about that in a few moments. And then
you can close the New York Stock Exchange, shut down the fools in Indonesia.
In Florence, Italy, a woman will leap from the Duomo clutching a picture of your victim and cursing your name.
Your wife will weep.
His wife will weep.
The world will weep. Grief. Grief beyond imagining. Despair.
The death of innocence and hope.
The bitter burdens which you bear.
The bitter truths you carry in your heart. You can share them with the world.
You have the power of Pandora's box, Lee. Open it.
I envy you.
Family.
I admire you.
I respect you.
And it seemed as if the world stood still. People cried where they stood, wherever they stood. On street corners, in living rooms, in department stores, in the halls of Congress. And it seemed as if someone had struck a blow to the heart of every individual in the country. And all the fingers pointed to one lone man who had been arrested in a theater in Dallas. And then a few days later, not even that long, after protesting loudly his innocence, he was killed in the basement parking garage in a building just off Dealey Plaza where President Kennedy had met his death by a man named Ruby. Did Lee Harvey Oswald do it? No. No, ladies and gentlemen, regardless of what you've heard or what you've been told, Lee Harvey Oswald did not shoot John F. Kennedy. In fact, he was not even on the sixth floor of the Book Depository building. I'm holding in my hand now a photograph taken by James Altgens just seconds after the bullets that fired. And killed John Fitzgerald Kennedy, hit their mark, and B. Harvey Oswald is standing in the doorway, the open doorway, of the Book Depository building. And there are many detractors out there, all who are meant to detract and confuse, who say that that's a man named Lovelady, or Lovelace, and it is not. In fact, the man is wearing the exact same clothes that Lee Harvey Oswald was wearing when he was arrested. And it is, without any shadow of a doubt, Lee Harvey Oswald. For there's a little-known method of identifying people, ladies and gentlemen, that the world doesn't much want you to know about. It is the measurement to the bone structure, the distance between the nearest points of the eyes, the distance between the farthest points of the eyes, the distance between the pupils of the eyes, the distance between the point of the chin and the bridge of the nose, the distance from temple to temple, the distance from one corner of the lips to the other, the distance between the top lip and the nose, the distance between the tip of the nose and the bridge of the nose. All of these measurements can be used, and it doesn't matter whether you're measuring a real person or a tiny photograph, for the measurements will always be true to the correct proportion of the living person. And if you take a photograph where the head of an individual is only 1/8 of an inch in one photograph and make those measurements under magnification and compare them with the same measurements taken from a head where the head measures 2 inches in another photograph, the proportions will be exactly the same. And we have done that, ladies and gentlemen, with many different pictures of Lee Harvey Oswald. That photograph of the man standing in the doorway of the Book Depository building as the motorcade passes and the president is assassinated is, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald. So he could not have killed the president. And, in fact, he did not kill the president. All of you who have been listening to this broadcast for a long period of time and have either listened to or purchased the series known as the Mystery Schools or Mystery Babylon, understand the symbology of the true assassins. And the symbology holds all the way through, even through the Garrison trials and even right up to the president displayed in a movie called JFK, produced by one Oliver Stone. The symbology is always there. You see, the South, ladies and gentlemen, perpetrated the Civil War not from the will of the common man. The common man has never in history cried out for war. It was instigated by a group known as the Southern Jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. Albert Pike was a prominent Confederate general. After the war, Albert Pike was one of the creators of the Ku Klux Klan. B'nai B'rith was heavily involved. And so was British intelligence. All of these groups had much to gain by maintaining their relationship with England, by maintaining slavery, by maintaining what are known as states' rights, But you see, that was never really the question, although many say that it is. Slavery had nothing to do with the Civil War. States' rights really didn't have anything to do with the Civil War, although that's what you'll read in textbooks. It had to do with money. It had to do with the attempt to break up the union of the several states so that England could again get a foothold in the New World. In fact, the goal of British intelligence was to break the back of the Union and rule the colonies, as they called it, once again. These secret societies that I have revealed to you speak in symbology. You see, Dealey Plaza, ladies and gentlemen, is an outdoor temple of the sun. It was not the United States government, or the CIA, or the Office of Naval Intelligence that killed John F. Kennedy. It was not the mafia or the mob. It was a group of secret societies, all using the same symbology, who all have the same goal of a one-world totalitarian socialist government who are racist at the core of their beliefs. And that's the real reason John F. Kennedy was killed. He was integrating America. He was mixing the races. And that's a no-no. See, even today, the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry has separate lodges for blacks and whites and the Jews. The Jews' lodge is called B'nai B'rith. For the whites, it's called the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry Southern Jurisdiction. And for the blacks, it's called the Prince Hall Lodge. Why blacks and Jews ever buy into this sham, I never know. But at the heart of it, it always goes back to Israel. And in the ceremony, the secret ceremonies in these lodges, you will see the reenactment of things that supposedly happened hundreds of years ago. You will see people who pretend to be Christians, who pretend to be Lutherans or Catholics and even atheists, dress in the robes of the ancient priesthoods, and reenact pagan religious ceremonies and circumambulate about the lodge as the master sits in the east, representing the rising sun, the source of true illumination. No one sits in the north. For according to the Bible, that's where the God of the Bible sits, and that is not their God. The north is said to be a dark and terrible, evil place. Remember the pledge of Lucifer that he would take over and sit in the throne on the side of the mountain in the north. These men believe in the Luciferian philosophy, which is the generative force represented by a phallus. They believe in a trinity represented by a triangle, the exact shape of Dealey Plaza. They believe that man himself can become God. And this triangle represents the three forces of generation: thought, desire, action. They're saved by their works. The generative force, or that which gets things done, is represented by the phallus. That which was lost. When Osiris was chopped into pieces and scattered about the land. Isis went to find him and found all but one, the penis or the phallus of Osiris, the lost word of Freemasonry. In Dealey Plaza, Dealey Plaza is shaped like a pyramid, truncated, in fact, with the eye represented by the underpass going over or under the railroad overpass. There is a phallus, an obelisk, if you will, surmounted by the representation of the god of these secret societies, the eternal flame, for they are known as the philosophers of fire. Near the obelisk is a reflecting pool. The pool represents the goddess Isis, reflecting the light, the pure light of her master. And from this mystic union is born the child Horus, which is representative of the full body of the adepts, the initiates, those who have gone through the 3 degrees and 6 acts, represented by the number 18 or 666. It is the number of a man. It is the man who will rule in the New World Order. The mystery of the jog off Main Street down Houston and turned left on Elm is simply because in the symbology of the mystery schools, the ancient mystery religions of Babylon and Egypt and Rome, the sacrifice of the king was always committed in a grove. The grove is represented in Dealey Plaza by Elm Street. It is, in fact, a temple of the sun, much like Stonehenge, with the four quarters of the temple arrayed about Dealey Plaza. This is something that you are never told, and that you would never know if you did not listen to this broadcast. President Kennedy was wounded in the exact 3 same spots as Hiram Abiff, who was murdered in the Masonic initiation, representing the persecution of the Templars on Friday the 13th in the year 1307, where Hiram Abiff is struck in the back and in the throat and in the head. Dealey Plaza is just a very few short miles from the 33rd parallel, the highest degree of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, the meritorious degree, the degree of the Illuminati, whose motto is Ordo Ab Chao, or out of chaos comes order, which literally means if they break down the existing structure and cause the population to cry out for order, they will emerge as the rulers and will have the world that they seek. Jim Garrison, when he arrested those in New Orleans who were implicated in the plot, found that the address that they were operating out of had a door numbered 1313 and the other door a number that added up to 13 if you added the individual numbers. Significant symbology of the Knights Templar and the Freemasonic Lodge and B'nai B'rith, all complicit. You see, Giuseppe Mazzini had corresponded with Albert Pike in the 1800s. And he had put together an Italian branch of the Illuminati from Italian youth street gangs. This became what you know as the Mafia. The link has nothing to do with organized crime or intelligence agencies. The link is between secret societies who all have the same goal, to establish the Anglo-Aryan race as the true descendants of the lost tribe of Israel, to establish the House of Windsor upon the throne of the world as the true descendant of the House of David, and subjugate all other races and peoples to abject, utter, and complete slavery. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is who killed John F. Kennedy and why. We have the Zapruder film available, which you can study. If you'd like to send $1 in a self-addressed stamped number 10 size envelope, we will send you an information pack. I would suggest that you get that videotape, for it explains a lot. When I was attached to the Office of Naval Intelligence, I saw a document which stated that Kennedy had been killed by the driver of his car. And I spent many years looking for something that would show me that. And in 1988, John Lear said he had a copy of the film. John Lear is the son of William P. Lear, of Learjet fame. I obtained that film from him. He told me that he had obtained it from a Central Intelligence Agency agent, whom he could not name, who later turned out to be a man named Lars Hansen, who called me and brought me a copy of the film. He gave it to me. He was a volunteer upon my staff when I made my presentation at Hollywood High School in Los Angeles in 1989. He helped videotape the event. Later, he claimed that he knew nothing about my using the videotape that he gave me that showed, or appeared to show, the driver turn around and shoot Kennedy, holding a pistol in his left hand and shooting over his right shoulder. Later turned out that he had a link to Tom Valentine, the Stell group, or the Stell Society, another group that had as its god Lucifer. Borne out by an interview given by Tom Valentine to Richard Noon, and a book called 5-5-2000, Ice, the Ultimate Disaster, where Tom Valentine makes the statement that Lucifer, that Jesus Christ failed, and now it was Lucifer's turn. The leader of the Stell group had also gone on record as saying that their god was Lucifer. Then we find Lars Hansen suddenly showing up with Bo Greitz. And Greitz writes a book saying that I stole the film, and that I'm a charlatan. And as you know, if you've listened to this broadcast, I've proven that to be a lie in his own words. And you can get those tapes too. But folks, we have been had. For many years we have been had. Took me many years to finally obtain a first generation copy of the Zapruder film, and that's the one we have. It's the best you'll ever see, in brilliant color, sharp detail. There is none better anywhere outside the original. And on it you can see, ladies and gentlemen, that someone has severely doctored that film, scraped off whole sections of emulsion, either to hide the fact that William Greer, the driver, shot William Kennedy, or to make it look like he did. They also scraped the emulsion off John F. Kennedy's wounds so that you cannot see the true wounds or the true extent of the wounds. However, they did not touch the back of the head. And what you will find on that film, ladies and gentlemen, is that there is no wound to the back of John F. Kennedy's head whatsoever. He was hit with an exploding bullet on the right side of his face, just between the eye and the temple at forehead level. This bullet exploded and blew away literally half his head. There is no entrance wound on the back of his head, and there is no exit wound on the back of his head. So who shot John F. Kennedy? It's not who that counts. For all of them together, all of the members of these secret societies are guilty. It makes no difference who actually pulled the trigger. It's why. And where is it going to take us? You see, they planted their symbol on his grave in their arrogance and their disdain for him and for us. The philosophers of fire are laughing still. And Robert Groden, who gave false testimony to Congress and who has been telling you that he is the expert, civilian, independent analyst of the Zapruder film, has never, ever told you the truth. Good night. God bless you. And please, wake up. Another man who wrote a book to confuse you about the Kennedy assassination is Mark Lane. Did you know that the Jonestown experiment was a CIA-run experiment and the Jonestown massacre also was an experiment in mind control? Did you know that Mark Lane was Jim Jones' lawyer and that now he is the lawyer for the Liberty Lobby? Never.